Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, February 14, 2017. Humanitarian agencies make a big push for donor money to help the people of South Sudan.
Of the $1.6 billion that we're requesting, the vast majority is towards food aid, so providing food aid to the population of South Sudan. We want to take care of the shelter needs, the health needs, the water and sanitation needs of many people across the country.
And some South Sudanese in the diaspora say the JMAC has failed.
JMAC has become the mouthpiece of the government of Juba, the government in Juba, and then other international players, and not South Sudanese who want to see peace at all costs, and not South Sudanese who want to see an inclusive peace.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Humanitarian organizations operating in South Sudan are appealing for $1.6 billion US dollars to provide relief and protection to people across the country this year. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in South Sudan says the humanitarian situation has deteriorated rapidly, with some 7 million people in need of assistance. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Ian Ridley is the head of UN OCHA in South Sudan. Ridley says the endless cycle of conflict, the worsening economic crisis, and the changes in climate are all causing humanitarian conditions to deteriorate in South Sudan.
Since the holidays, when there was a brief respite in the conflict, the humanitarian crisis has just continued to deepen and spread. As we saw in January, conflict started again in parts of Equatoria and Upper Nile. This has forced more people from their homes.
During the conflict, Ridley says horrendous atrocities have been reported, including widespread sexual violence, and he says food insecurity and malnutrition have skyrocketed, adding many more South Sudanese communities are at risk of famine unless the food crisis is averted. Ridley says most of the donor money from 2016 is going toward providing food for the hungry.
Of the $1.6 billion that we're requesting, the vast majority is towards food aid, so providing food aid to the population of South Sudan. We want to take care of the shelter needs, the health needs, the water and sanitation needs of many people across the country, as well as take care of the education and protection needs of affected people, especially vulnerable women and children.
There are significant outbreaks of cholera in the former Unity and Central Equatoria states, according to Ridley. He adds that acute diarrheal disease seems to be spreading fast. He is urging the parties to the conflict to lay down their guns so that the more than 1.5 million people who were forced to flee their villages can return home. UN agencies say since the conflict began in late 2013, about 3.4 million people have been forced to flee their homes, including nearly 1.9 million who are internally displaced and about 1.5 million more who fled to neighboring countries. Ridley says so far this year, aid agencies estimate 7.5 million people across South Sudan need humanitarian assistance and protection. For VOA News, I am Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Some South Sudanese in the diaspora are reacting to statements made by the chairman of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMAC, last week in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Speaking to the BBC Focus on Africa program, Festus Mohai said the 2015 peace agreement is still alive. But a South Sudanese human rights activist and legal expert disagrees. Remember, Mia Mingi says JMAC has failed completely and should leave South Sudan.
I'm disappointed by the chair of JMAC for the statement that he had made to the media over the past 3 days. The first statement was that he called the other parties to the agreement who are fighting right now in South Sudan to surrender, come to Juba, and ask the president to grant them amnesty. Now, this will indicate to me that, number one, GEMEC has taken sides with the government. And that's why it's calling the other party to come and then surrender. Number two, that GEMEC then can no longer be a neutral, impartial, and an objective referee in a process where it is already taken sides. So that's the first reason.
GEMEC would argue that they are doing that in the interest of peace, for South Sudanese to live in peace. What is your reaction to that?
It was South Sudanese parties and the guarantors to the peace agreement who signed the peace agreement and said that there is no peace in South Sudan without accountability, that there is no peace in South Sudan without justice. How can GEMEC now determine what is in the interest of South Sudanese when South Sudanese have put their interest down in a peace agreement? So it cannot be in the interest of South Sudan. In fact, it was in the interest of South Sudan. How can GEMEC stand and say, when we have not heard from the AU, when we have not heard from IGAD, that the region have decided that one of the main parties to the agreement, led by Dr. Riek Machar, is barred from returning to South Sudan? Is that decision in the interest of the peace agreement? It is simply the only parties we have heard that from has been the American government and the government of South Sudan. So by repeating that, what GEMEC has become is that it is really has become the mouthpiece of the government of Juba, the government in Juba, and then other international players, and not South Sudanese who want to see peace at all costs, and not South Sudanese who want to see an inclusive peace.
Doctor, remember, it looks like you don't have any kind words for GEMEC. But they've tried their best in a situation where it's very difficult to contain the two parties from fighting each other. Why are you not giving them credit where it's due?
What has happened is that if GEMEC has recognized that it has failed in implementing the peace agreement, the most honorable thing for President Festus Mogae to do and GEMEC is to tell South Sudanese people and international community that we have tried our best, we have failed, and therefore resign and leave. But to stay there and then engage in an offensive mission of disinformation to South Sudanese, telling them the peace agreement is to be implemented, when we know that the situation is worse now than it was when the peace agreement was signed.
And if I would ask you one question, if there is any success story of GEMEC, what would that success story be?
The only success story I know was the establishment of GEMEC within the peace agreement. But since GEMEC was established, GEMEC did first, it pushed for the transitional government to be established, which was to its credit, but that was all. Once the transitional government of national unity collapsed in July, therefore, with the peace agreement collapsing, the existence, the mandate, the importance and the usefulness of GEMEC ceased to be. And from that day on, GEMEC is operating on its own account and cannot claim to make any progress.
That's Remember Miamingi, South Sudanese human rights activist and a legal expert at the Center for Human Rights, University of Pretoria in South Africa. He was speaking to me earlier today. Education officials in Yei River State say they will provide free education in all public schools. This despite widespread insecurity outside Yei Town, which has forced many schools to remain closed. Tito Justin has the story for VOA from Juba.
Education officials in Yei River State acknowledge that deadly violence caused several schools to shut down in the state's 13 counties. Tens of thousands of villagers have fled their homes and are seeking refuge in camps in neighboring Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Amule Felix, Director General at the State Education Ministry, says state officials decided to offer free education to families still trapped in Yei Town to encourage parents to send their children to school.
Education is really a key. It is a transformational tool that will change the lives of people. The more educated people we have in the society, the better services we'll deliver and the better economic and social situation that we will experience, because the graduates then will get employed.
Felix says the state is merging schools outside of the town with those in town because teachers and students have fled the area due to fighting between government forces and armed militia group.
We need peace so that the environment of learning is conducive. And as we talk now, we have even gone into seeing that children are protecting the school. Every school should have a fence and having one gate guarded by a watchman so that the entry and the exit of the children is watched.
Before the fighting broke out in Yei, parents paid tuition fees for their children to study in government schools. Betty Ropani has four children attending school at St. Emmanuel Public Primary School. Speaking in Arabic, Ropani says she paid an average of 1,500 South Sudanese pounds per year in tuition fees for each child.
We as mothers are happy because of this. We are only thinking because we are tired of hunger as they are not giving us anything. How will they help us? Secondly, we are just seated here doing nothing because of the insecurity.
Yei Town resident Malice Gordon has five children. Gordon says free education now does not really help because of the widespread insecurity around the area.
I don't know whether it can be favorable because almost the parents, even the pupils, are always traumatized of all the happenings from one way, like this killing, like this bullet shooting. So to me, sometimes it's not fair because there's no peace. We don't have to still the security situation to be normal. For example, a pupil might be going to the school and while studying and maybe such happening like bullet shoot and maybe running up of people, it will put the intention of the people very far because you might be thinking of what will happen.
Education officials admit most teachers and pupils have already fled Yei because of the fighting. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the ideal of romantic love. Where does it come from? Find out on this Valentine's Day when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what responsibility do you take most seriously?
My family, of course. I love looking after them most time. That's a responsibility I would love to take even when I, you know, when I go up a bit or maybe when I grow up.
My education right now is the most responsibility I take seriously because I impart more time in it. Because I'm targeting my future right now. So if it's future, that is what I should focus on most.
I feel the responsibility that I can value and take as important in life is seeing that my vision for the fashion house I hold has come to pass as I need it.
The family. Family is the responsibility I take mostly serious. In most cases, family comes first. Say there's things, enjoy, pain.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's Tuesday, so it's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about the psychology of mass killers. President Trump says his executive orders stopping travel to the United States from several countries will prevent terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. Many disagree. Forensic psychologists study the motivation and the backgrounds of mass killers. A leading authority on this topic says many factors contribute to their action. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
Hold your candles for who we lost.
49 names, read at a vigil in Florida last year, identified the victims of the worst mass shooting in U.S. history, the slaughter at an Orlando nightclub. Children were among the 86 people killed in a murderous attack by a truck driver in Nice, France. 12 died in a mass shooting at the Navy Yard in Washington 4 years ago. Studies by the FBI, the Harvard School of Public Health, and others show the frequency of mass killings has tripled in the past few years. In the U.S., semi-automatic rifles are the killers' preferred weapons, but they also have used trucks filled with fertilizer, which can be detonated as a powerful explosive, as in Oklahoma City in 1995. In 2001, the weapons of terror were airplanes, commandeered by hijackers and deliberately flown into buildings in New York and Washington. J. Reed Malloy is a forensic psychologist who studies mass killings. He's also a professor of psychiatry at the University of California in San Diego. Malloy spoke to VOA via Skype.
But we find that these individuals typically have more in common than they do in terms of differences.
In an interview, Malloy said mass killers often have a history of psychiatric problems. They are mostly men. They have rocky, intimate relationships. And the killings are a quest for status, as in the Orlando nightclub shooting.
The individual also had some criminal background, and then he attempted to burnish, it appears, he attempted to burnish his reputation, perhaps inflate his notoriety by pledging allegiance during the mass murder itself to ideologically opposed groups, which was interesting in and of itself. He pledged allegiance to a Sunni group as well as to Hezbollah, which is Shia, and they, of course, have been at war for 1,300 years.
Malloy says even if killers claim to have a cause, that's not necessarily the reason for their actions.
Oftentimes, the pathway to violence begins with a personal grievance. And that grievance has three components to it. One is there's some kind of loss. Secondly, there's the feeling of humiliation. And then thirdly, there's anger toward and blaming of a person or a group of people that have caused them to have this problem.
Malloy says access to weapons enables these attacks, but the prospect of gaining attention on social media is another important factor motivating them. Social media can make a despicable attacker infamous. And when others see these killings, sometimes live streamed on social media, they want to imitate them. Malloy says people who experience violence are more likely to become violent. And finally, he calls easy access to social media a bad omen for the future, when he expects to see more mass killings throughout the world. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Around the world, thousands of children have been recruited or abducted for use as soldiers. Rights groups lay the blame on government forces, militia, and rebel groups. The psychological scars that many of these children bear make it difficult for them to re-enter society or to trust government institutions. But a recent workshop in northern Uganda aimed to change that. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
For years, Uganda's Gulu district was known for the abduction of thousands of kids by the Lord's Resistance Army. LRA rebels would come in the night to kidnap them, often killing their family members as they watched. The six-day workshop was held there at a secondary and vocational school in Kirindongo. The workshop brought together former child soldiers and children from both Uganda and South Sudan. They were youth leaders in their early 20s and older. The group, Education Above All, joined with actor Forrest Whitaker's Peace and Development Initiative to sponsor the workshop from February 6th through the 10th. King's College law professor Malia Malik is an advisor for Education Above All and designed the course outline for the workshop.
One was a syllabus about how the participants in the workshop from northern Uganda and South Sudan could take ideas about making schools safe, and particularly the demilitarization of schools in South Sudan, how they could develop campaigns and take some of those ideas back to their own communities. And the second syllabus was to have a film discussion around a film called Sometimes in April.
Sometimes in April is a 2005 historical drama about the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Nearly 1 million Tutsi and moderate Hutu were killed in a matter of months.
So I used that film to have a discussion about the process in which societies use ethnic classifications and the way in which that develops into dehumanization and leads to extermination, really. So we sort of stopped the film and had a discussion about Rwanda.
The discussion centered on mechanisms used to find justice, like the International Criminal Court. Professor Malik says there were mixed reactions to the ICC.
I had a discussion with them about the recent controversies in Eastern Africa, about withdrawal from the ICC that was discussed at the African Union recently. The youth leaders themselves had mixed feelings, because on the one hand, they are really interested in being part of a system of global justice. But on the other hand, they were really skeptical about the role of the UN and what they see as being the inability to hold large powers accountable.
The workshop focused on leadership, peace building, and business skills.
I think it's very important for youth leaders in these two countries who were brought together in order to allow them to build bonds across national, ethnic, linguistic differences to understand the mechanisms of universal principles, not just universal legal principles, but universal ethical principles about how one lives together without allowing ethnic, cultural, linguistic differences to become the basis for violence.
Malik says the Ugandan and South Sudanese youth leaders who attended the workshop had different perspectives.
There was an interesting contrast between northern Uganda on the one hand, which is in a post-conflict reconstruction phase, and South Sudan, which is still in an acute conflict stage. And what was very depressing and sad for me was to hear first-hand experience from the youth leaders from South Sudan that there's a substantial, from what they were saying, increase in recruitment into militias of children as the fighting has picked up in the last 12 months.
Malik calls education a human right. She says only by equipping children and young people with the knowledge they need to build a better future for themselves and their country can we start to rebuild and reconstruct communities. Actor Forrest Whitaker says young people who attended the workshop have been active peace builders for some time through the Youth Peacemaker Network program. He adds that they have already accomplished a lot for their communities. Whitaker began working with kids from conflict zones after hearing their stories while working on the film Last King of Scotland. He portrayed former Ugandan leader Idi Amin, a role for which he won a Golden Globe and an Academy Award. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Today is Valentine's Day. The ideal of romantic love is rooted in the European Renaissance about five centuries ago. It continues today through novels, films, and a big push from the candy industry. But according to a Senegal-born Suleiman Bashir Diani, an African philosophy professor at Columbia University in New York, traditional African cultures have a different view of how boy meets girl and what happens next. He spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips about it.
First of all, in my culture, when a young man is interested in a young woman, right from the beginning, it already is a kind of social affair. The way in which this would happen is that when you go and visit, you would go with friends. You would go also traditionally with a griot. The griot is this man who is a genealogist, an entertainer, etc. So it becomes right from the beginning, many other people are involved, and you come and visit with all of them sitting around. The griot might be singing a few songs, explaining who you are, who your ancestors are, so that people who are listening know exactly what your background is. And of course, the woman would have also called a few friends and they would greet you that way. And this is something you are going to do again and again.
But isn't there any kind of provision made for what we in the West would call chemistry? I mean, aren't they supposed to be attracted to each other somehow? Don't they ever get a chance to be alone together, even for a minute?
Of course, they can sort of give you some kind of privacy so that you discuss things of mutual interest, let's call it like that. But you would always be surrounded by your friends, her friends, etc.
Now, one thing that's interesting about that is that it demonstrates in a very tangible way the fact that society has a stake in this alliance. It's not just two individuals fulfilling themselves, but they're part of a web. Is that would you say a difference between the African view broadly understood and what we understand in the West?
You are absolutely right. It is understood right from the beginning that what you have in mind is a marriage.
Do they have an equivalent in traditional indigenous culture in Africa to this idea of love and love being the be-all and the end-all? I mean, is there necessarily any physical attraction necessarily? Does there have to be some of that there? Or is it really that just sort of an economic arrangement?
Well, it is understood by society that you have to see each other and you have to give chance to the idea of attraction, except that this is not something you are going to utter. For example, a young woman would not respond to your declaration of love by another declaration of love. There is a kind of shyness, which is a stage. I mean, you have this kind of staging and scripted way of saying things. It is all in euphemism and managing the shyness, supposed shyness.
In the West, you fall in love and then the commitment comes later. I'm wondering if in indigenous culture, you make the commitment and that's when love really starts.
Right. But I mean, I guess you would find also in the West elements of those traditional ways of doing things. Because when we compare the West to Africa, for example, we should be aware that we might be comparing the West as it is now to an Africa which is fast disappearing as well. For example, I could tell you that more and more in Senegal, especially in cities, you would find people celebrating Valentine's Day exactly as it is celebrated in Paris or in the United States. It is still not really the culture, but attention to Valentine's Day and advertisement, because capitalism knows how to universalize itself. The selling of, you know, fancy restaurants or Valentine's cakes or things like that, or making a gift, giving something to your wife or your fiancé, is developing very, very fast.
That was Columbia University African philosophy professor Soleimani Bashir Diani. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Anyaka Yele by Sultan Clinton.
It's your choice to change your goal. It's your choice to change your goal. Leli 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 leli. Oh, now I yell, mama. Oh, oh. Maybe it's your choice to change. I never yell, papa. Leli leli mama. Oh, 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 pretty soon we get to marry. Life is too short to hurry. Baby, 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 baby.
We've been listening to Sultan Clinton with the song Anyaka Yele. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
It's time to marry you, baby. It's up to you if you want to change.
It's all up to you, baby. It's all up to you, baby.
No time to waste, no time to waste. Baby girl, it's up to you, my lady.